Strange to me talking about the angels, but it's actually more difficult to sort of include theology with the depictions, with icons of saints and of Christ and the feast. It's very easy to intertwine not a theology, but so this is largely more historical, really, just describing how the different ranks of angels are depicted. I'm not going to be like the previous one, going historically through time, but at least showing the different ways that they're depicted. Have in mind again, as I mentioned last time, that especially with the high ranks of angels, seraphim and cherubim and the thrones and all these wheels and all that, that none of this is to be taken literally. It's all just indicating characteristics of these angels. Of course, the starting point is Pseudo-Dionysius the Areopagite's The Celestial Hierarchies, where he describes our nine ranks of angels: seraphim, cherubim, thrones, dominions, virtues, powers, principalities, archangels, and angels. So I will cover these nine types of angels in this talk. There's also the four living creatures, the tetramorph. Some combine these with the cherubim, sort of say the type of cherubim, but I'll treat them as a distinctive feature. This is sort of shows most of the types. So you've got the angels, archangels, the four living creatures, the ones with wheels, which are often associated with thrones, and the six and the seraphim. So it's an interesting image that it shows basically all the types in one image. Yes, of course. Epitaphius means literally on the tomb. So this is a cloth with the depiction of Christ on the tomb, and this is used liturgically on Good Friday. So Christ has died, we become the myrrh-bearers, wrapping his body up, putting him in the tomb. But it's sort of Orthodox liturgical hymnography loves contrast. So here you've got a body, a dead body. But you've got all this incredible splendour of heaven. So this man in a block of stone remains the King of Glory. He remains as God, the sustainer and creator of the whole universe. So here you've got this contrast, you know, that he never ceases to be God while he's dead in his humanity. So that's the emphasis there. The King of Glory. And of course, on the sign above Christ's crucifixion, instead of the King of the Jews, generally in Eastern iconography, of the King of Glory, just to sort of make the point. He doesn't cease to be God when he's crucified and suffering. In reality, in terms of depictions, we only really have depictions of the seraphim, cherubim, thrones, and very rarely of dominions, virtues, powers, and principalities. And then we have, of course, depictions of archangels and angels. We've really covered archangels and angels already, so I'll be concentrating on seraphim, cherubim, and thrones, and the four living creatures. So let's look at the seraphim first. These are six-winged creatures here, and the basic text is from Isaiah chapter 6, verses 1 to 8. So these are very near to the Lord, very close to the Lord. They're in attendance to him, and they generally are considered situated above his throne. And in Isaiah it says they had six wings, two covering their faces, two covering their feet, and two for flying. And they cry out, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And also he mentions that they come and pick up a live coal with tongs. So as you'll see, that they have these six wings here. Sometimes they hold a censer, so that's sort of relating to the live coals. That's a censer, of course, as a live coal. And later on, you have a staff with "Holy, Holy, Holy" written on it. So that's the basis, really, of iconographic depictions of the seraphim taken from Isaiah chapter 6. Sometimes you have the feet showing, because Isaiah talks about six covering the feet, but more often than not, they're like here, there are no feet, just the face in the middle. Sometimes with the hands sticking out with little signs with "Holy, Holy, Holy." So this is a splendid seraphim here. Only recently the face was uncovered, the Muslims have put a disc over the face. I'll show you a photograph. I'll jump to it now. I think it's the next one. Here we are. That's the face. That's the scale of these. Incredible, isn't it? That's just uncovered a few years ago. So I'll mention a few places where the seraphim are commonly found. So one place is the Pendatives. Roughly from the 11th century onwards, you tend, of course, to get the four evangelists in the four Pendatives. The Pendatives are wonderful structures. When you have a dome connected to a drum, you have this problem. You've got a circular drum that's got to be connected to a cubic nave. So what do you do with a circle? Is this, I've got a pen here. Ooh, I didn't think that. No matter. Yeah. See, you've got a circle that's got a meter square. And you can see the top of the circle here. So the whole thing would collapse. So somehow you've got to combine a square with the circle. So the Byzantines created the Pendative, which is like a curved triangle. So structurally, it's really, really important. But basically, it's at the meeting point. What's the word? So you've got a meeting point of heaven and earth. So looking from above, you've got the circle with the square. And the dome will collapse here. So you've got on the side. You've got the curved triangle here. So it supports. And this is heaven. This is where Christ is depicted here. Generally, there are angels here. I'm talking about this iconography, the four evangelists, who are the interface of the Old Testament and the New. Interface between heaven and earth, because God comes to earth, being described in the four Gospels. And then that creates saints, who depict them around here. And then you have the Acts here. So God becomes man through the mother of God, is depicted there, and comes to earth. But in the early church, before that, iconography was established, sometimes you get the seraphim there. Now, of course, if you're looking eastwards, you've got what's called the triumphal arch with the axe there, with the altar there. Now, if you have the seraphim there, or the cherubim, does that remind you of anything in the Old Testament?
The Ark of the Covenant.
Exactly. So the altar becomes the Ark of the Covenant, and they are reaching over the Ark of the Covenant. So it's wonderful. So many sort of meanings. And this is the triumphal arch. It's the entrance into the city, if you like. Entrance into the city of the kingdom of heaven. Is there a top to this? This is what I love about iconography within the church structure. It's not just what is depicted that's iconographic, but where it is. That's profound theology. I'd like to write a whole book on that. I've got a chapter in my book on it. Just about some of the theology of the placement of things. So you have seraphim, sometimes and Pendatives, these are called. Sometimes in the drum, or the drum is the sort of the cylinder that supports the dome, or sometimes they're compressed into one here, and that's on the drum itself, and this is the dome itself, and this is the drum. So in this case, where they're there, they represent the first phase of creation. So if you work from the top down, this is history. So you get the creator here, then you get the angels, the first creator, then the Old Testament prophets and patriarchs, and then you get all the New Testament down here. So this is sort of the movement of God's economy from the top down. Although it's closest to the throne of God and it's furthest away, if you like. So here you've got the thrones, which is probably the name we ought to apply to the wheels that Ezekiel describes, and seraphim, and these would be the archangels. Then you've got the Old Testament prophets and patriarchs around here.
Do stop me at any time, don't you, if you want to ask anything. Another common place where they're depicted is the epitaphius. You've seen this before. So you've got the seraphim all around here. the turgible fans, that's another time when they're depicted. This is one I did for Iveron. I lived in Moni Iveron in Mount Athos for a total of 2 years and had a great job. After I'd done my apprenticeship of washing dishes, then at the sawmill, and in the last year, I was like a monastery artist, and Father Vesalius asked me to make the liturgical fans. So these would be either side of the holy table, and then, of course, they're used in procession. And this has great theological significance. We should never just consider stuff in churches as decoration. Its placement always has profound significance. So when we see these liturgical fans, exekterigma, they're called in Greek, six-winged, remind ourselves that we're before the throne of God. We're Ezekiel beholding the Lord high and lifted up. Now, we're not just sort of pretending to reenact something that happens in heaven. We are participating in the very thing that Ezekiel saw, which is the Lord of glory enthroned in the heaven with a seraphim around. There's only one liturgy. Bishop Callistos often says of the priesthood. There's one priest, that's Christ, some are priests, and all of us are priests. So we can say this of the liturgy. There's only one liturgy. There are some liturgies every Sunday, but the whole of life needs to be a liturgy as well. But all those things are a participation, really, in the one and only liturgy, which is ceaseless. So when we see these exoteriga, we must remind ourselves that we are worshipping with all the angels and all the saints in heaven. And of course, these are brought out and processed. So in a way, these are linked to the epitaphios. When we bring out the bread and the wine, in a sense, it's like a procession of Christ's body in to be, well, the bread and wine to be transformed into the body and blood of Christ. So when the exoteriga are there, it's a bit related to this procession on Holy Friday. So it's all to do with the King of Glory, really. Another place where sometimes we find seraphim is over the deacon's doors. This is my church in Shrewsbury. So here you've got it, six-winged seraphim above the door. And of course, the cherubim, we talk about seraphim now, but the cherubim and seraphim often get all muddled up together. They guard the entrance to paradise, to the tree of life. So here, they open the door, they're allowing paradise and earth to come back together. Another place that I've shown is in the apse with the King of Glory. Now, when you have that's a typical Byzantine church, which is a dome church in the middle, in the apse, you virtually always have Christ enthroned here and the Mother of God here. But if you have a typical Western church with a basilica, you've got no dome. So you've got your roof here, you've got your columns. There's no roof to frescoes, it's only timber roof. So the apse becomes the most important place. Here, that's the most important. But the apse becomes the most important. You can't put Christ up here, it's just a wooden roof. So generally, with basilicas, you have Christ depicted in glory here. This is a Romanesque one from Spain. So very often you have seraphim in here. So that becomes the dome, effectively, the equivalent to the Orthodox dome. And down here, I'll show you close up, you've got the thrones, the wheels as well. And you've got the angels at the top here. This is, I'm not being to it myself, but this is in, which museum this is? Is it in Barcelona? Catalonia. That's a close-up. So here you have the many-eyed seraphim with the eyes on, and here you've got the flaming wheels, the thrones. So again, when we're worshipping in a church and see this, it's there to tell us, you are participating in the heavenly worship. Here you have the hands visible and the feet down below. So this is a literal rendition, really, of Isaiah's vision. Two, they cover the feet. Actually, two, they cover the face. It's partially covering the halo here. And with two, they fly up the hands out here. What do you think is signified by the many eyes? Why have many eyes? One, just two or one?
I don't know the answer, somebody can tell you. I suppose it's just sort of spiritual vision, right, I presume.
There's that him, he watches and he only wants.
Yes, I suppose hardly watching, beholding. They never. There's no back to. He's always looking. Yeah. Once, when I was praying the Jesus prayer, I just had the sense that I disappeared and there was only God there, and then I, all in a sort of instant, then I realised, well, to behold God, not that I saw anything, but you know, you feel in your heart sometimes you're with the Lord. Then I realised. To behold the Lord in my heart, I had to exist. So I realised really the function of man is just to be one big eye, to behold the Lord. And I suppose contemplation is that, isn't it? The contemplative beings. And Father Zechariah has talked a lot about this. When you're still, you can behold. When you're noisy, you can't look. That's one reason why the monastic life is called the angelic life. You know, I mean, all of us are called to be monastics in the sense of all of us are called to live as though only God alone exists. You know, we love our spouse, we love our children in Christ, so we never look away from Christ. We're always loving everything in Christ. So we never look away from Christ. So we should always be in the eye of ourselves. We do everything in Christ. There's no conflict between the material world, the spiritual, between our loved ones and Christ. We're doing everything in Christ. Another case where we see seraphim is in illuminated manuscripts. This is quite an interesting one from Durham. And each of the wings here and the feathers, I sort of take it as a teaching point of virtue for the Latin names here. I suggest the different things, like one is taking confession, another is repentance. So this is sort of taking the seraphim as a paragon of virtue, and it's like a teaching tool. We come now to the cherubim. We've covered seraphim now. Now, as I said, often seraphim and cherubim are all sort of muddled up. So these look exactly like seraphim, but here it's written cherubim. Has anyone been to Sicily? Kefalu, it's got three. Oh, I wish I'd. I've not been there. It's amazing, isn't it? Yeah, amazing. You've got three churches there, Palermo, Kefalu, and Moniale, with amazing mosaics. And one of the churches, I forget which, it's a real combination of Western Christianity, Byzantine Christianity, and Islam. The ceiling, the sort of stalactite ceiling, is made by Muslim craftsmen. Mosaics are taken from Byzantium, but it's a basilica church, so the Western iconography. Amazing stuff. So the cherubim are mentioned in the Torah, the five books of the Old Testament, the first five, in Ezekiel, Isaiah, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, and 1 and 2 Chronicles in relation to the construction of the temple. And also in Hebrews 9:5, referring to the Ark of the Covenant, the cherubim of the Ark of the Covenant. So in all those references, cherubim are mentioned in relation to guarding the entrance to paradise. When Adam and Eve are cast out of paradise, and the cherubim guard the entrance with a flaming sword. That's the first mention. And then the golden sculptures made of wood with gold. God told Moses to have these made over the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant. Then also he's told to put embroidered images of the cherubim on the veil between the holiest of holies and the holy place. And then Ezekiel sees them in his vision. So they're the main instances. Ezekiel equates the cherubim with the four living creatures. These are creatures that have, one has the face of a man, a lion, an ox, and an eagle. And of course, these are later taken to represent the four evangelists. But earlier on, they're just taken as a sort of a part of the nature of the cherubim. And in the liturgy, we talk about the many-eyed seraphim and cherubim. We say, "We also thank you for this liturgy, which you are pleased to accept from our hands, even though you are surrounded by thousands of archangels and tens of thousands of angels, by the cherubim and seraphim, six-winged, many-eyed, soaring with their wings." So we hear this in the liturgy, every liturgy.
So here, Stirbo and the Serpent are sort of conflated as being both of them six-winged and many-eyed, soaring with the wings. Some commentators say the Hebrew word cherubim means effusion of wisdom. Some relate it to the Syrian term krabu, which means great and mighty, and also Babylonian words, which mean propitious and blessed. Some scholars say that the Hebrews sort of got the idea of sort of six-winged creatures or winged creatures with the heads of animals from these Assyrian creatures, the Lamassu, and they guarded the throne of the king. So who knows what sort of cross-fertilization there was. Maybe these only have two wings, but this conflation of human heads, animal bodies and wings. So where do we find cherubim mentioned? Or where they're used iconographically? I just love this image here. It's quite humorous, really. You've got the cherubim here, holding the flaming sword, and you've got the repentant thief. He's Peter and all these righteous men here, Peter and the disciples. He sort of jumped the gun. I think this is marvellous, kind of divine humour. Now the thief just kicks in at the last minute. So he enters here, and so that's one common place where seraphim are depicted. Here they've got four wings, and they're red, they're fiery in themselves. You generally only find that in frescoes, and not in portable icons. It's in Gradaccio Nietzsche in Serbia. An unusual image. Here, this is an icon from Sinai. I think it's 1200. And here, it's written here in Greek, cherubim. One can only guess, well, you'll probably know, why would this be included with Macarius?
Well, it's a scene from the Coptic life of St. Macarius where a cherub appears to him. And as the text has it, crucifies him upon the earth. Mm. So it's that particular account in his life. Which is obviously quite unusual.
Yeah, show how exalted he was.
Yeah,
that's the average, thank you. We come now to the third rank, the thrones, or ophanim, that's sometimes called in Hebrew, which means literally wheels. So in the vision of Ezekiel, he talks about the four living creatures, or the cherubim with four heads, with wheels underneath. And it seems like a wheel within a wheel. So you've got a wheel here inside another wheel. And they've got eyes all around. And where these creatures go, the wheels go. And he talks about the spirits of the living creatures are in the wheels. So they're sort of conflated together. And they're called thrones, so it's often related to the throne as described by Dionysius, because they're underneath the throne of God. They're like the sort of the chariot, if you like, of Christ. It's like a moving throne and wheels. Ezekiel, in Ezekiel chapter 1, verses 15 to 21, we read, "As I looked at the living creatures, I saw a wheel on the ground beside each creature with its four faces. This was the appearance and structure of the wheels. They sparkled like topaz, and all four looked alike. Each appeared to be made like a wheel intersecting a wheel." So here we've got a wheel within a wheel. "As they moved, they would go in any one of the four directions the creatures faced. The wheels did not change direction as the creatures went." As it goes on, your mind gets more and more muddled. I don't think it's supposed to do that. "The rims were high and awesome, and all four rims were full of eyes all around. When the living creatures moved, the wheels beside them moved. And when the living creatures rose from the ground, the wheels also rose. Wherever the spirit would go, they would go, and the wheels would rise along with them, because the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. When the creatures moved, they also moved. When the creatures stood still, they also stood still. And when the creatures rose from the ground, the wheels rose along with them, because the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. And in Daniel 7:9, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took a seat. His clothing was as white as snow, and the hair of his head was white like wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze. So this configuration of wheels, throne, flaming fire, that sort of puts these sort of thrones in, and wheels all together. This is the ascension of Christ, obviously. So where do these thrones or these wheels occur? So around the feet of Christ is the most common place, probably. On the epitaphius, here you have them here. I couldn't get a colour picture of this. It's an amazing piece of embroidery, sort of rich reds and blues. And I, as you'll see in a minute, I based an embroidery design I did for Iveron to go around the Portatus Arachon on this work. And I studied this a lot. To me, it's a masterpiece of embroidery. And I noticed how the stars weren't regularly spaced and weren't actually all the same size, and they were a bit wonky. So I designed this into my own design, and then I gave it to the nuns to make. And they said, of course, we'll tidy up the stars. And I said, don't you touch them. You keep them irregular. Because our abbot had this lovely saying, it's a perfect imperfection and an imperfect perfection. If something's too perfect and regular, it's imperfect. If something's imperfect, it's got wonky, slightly wobbly side of the wards, it's perfect for the soul. Mm-hmm. And that's what I noticed about it. It's a brilliant piece. This is probably one of the earliest depictions of the four living creatures. This is St. Pudenciano in Rome, four living creatures here. The end of the 4th century. A lot of these mosaics in Rome have been hashed around in the 18th century, 19th century, and made naturalistic. But in fact, to our surprise, a lot of this here is actually the original. So it's a highly naturalistic early rendition before iconography got a bit more sort of abstract. I interrogated my students about 2 years ago, and I used to think of this, these indications, these depictions of Christ in Rome, just as Christ in heaven. But in fact, scholars believe that they're Christ's second coming. So here, it's quite naturalistic, but you tend to have these cloud arrangements here, and the arrangements of clouds, you used to see them on a sunrise. The sun is rising. So scholars think that, in fact, these are depictions of the second coming, sort of Christ rising over the horizon, like the rising sun. And here, of course, is the cross, which is what do we see in the second coming? The sign of glory, which is the church takes to be the cross. We come now to the tetramorph, the four living creatures. With time, they became sort of independent depictions and weren't sort of related so strongly to the other angels, mainly about the time they became associated with the four evangelists. So we talk about them now. Of course, Matthew the man, the man represents Matthew because Matthew's gospel emphasizes Christ's humanity and his human lineage. Mark represents the lion, representing Christ's divinity. And also his lion-like activity, the word immediately is used a lot by Mark. Immediately Christ did this, immediately did this. Really sort of active, dynamic, miracle-working Christ. Luke is represented by the ox because he emphasizes Christ's atoning sacrifice. And then John is the eagle. I mean, that's the mystical gospel. So it's like our spirits soar in these mystical visions. And also Christ is the Logos descending from heaven like an eagle. The the main source of these four living creatures is Ezekiel's vision, described in chapter 1, verses 4 to 14. I looked and saw a windstorm coming out of the north, an immense cloud with flashing lightning and surrounded by brilliant light. The centre of the fire looked like glowing metal, and in the fire was what looked like four living creatures. In appearance, their form was human, but each of them had four faces and four wings. Their legs were straight, their feet were like those of a calf and gleamed like burnished bronze. Under their wings, on their four sides, they had human hands. All four of them had faces and wings, and the wings of one touched the wings of another. So it seems that each of the four actually had four faces, but I think to save out of confusion, we sort of separated them into four creatures, each with one face. Each one went straight ahead, and they did not turn as they moved. Their faces were like this. Each of the four had the face of a human being, and on the right side each had the face of a lion, and on the left the face of an ox. Each also had the face of an eagle. Such were the faces. So where do we find the four living creatures, the tetramorph? Probably the most common is a gospel cover. This was done in either Germany or North Italy. So really common depictions are in relief, because being a gospel cover, it's handled a lot, it's knocked around. So you find them in ivory, beaten silver, enamel, Grosne enamel is very common, robust materials. This is, of course, the Book of Carols, written about 800, so here you have the four living creatures. These are inside the Gospel, they're not on the cover. So you might have these in the beginning of the four Gospels. As I mentioned in basilicas, the emphasis is on the apse. So you have Christ depicted there. And this is actually the Transfiguration. This is Christ being transfigured, and this is Peter, James, and John here, and then the other disciples here, and that's the hand of the Father. So this is actually not a table here, but here you have the four living creatures at the top. So you have, where you have Christ enthroned, more often than not, we have the four living creatures, often with the four wheels, the four thrones at the bottom. I just love our Romanesque painting. To me, it's the height of Western iconography. It's a time with this reasonable political, social stability, but it's still very much sort of intertwined with the Eastern Church theologically, and which is why I'm looking forward to reading your book about Thomas Aquinas. So you've got this political stability. You've still got the strong monastic life, the spirituality of the East largely, and it produces this wonderful iconography. This is a fresco I just finished in my church in Shrewsbury. It's a basilica, but it's just a rectangular church. So here you have Christ in glory, the four living creatures, the seraphim with the thrice holy. And here I've got stars. Stars are often used to depict the whole host of the angels. The heavenly host refers to the innumerable numbers of angels, and we think of all the stars in heaven. The number of angels is greater than the stars of heaven. So that's another way to depict the angels, the different types of stars. I talked earlier about the way the church is always trying to indigenize itself. So here I took elements of the undergarment of Christ from the stained glass windows from Canterbury Cathedral. And other elements of this I took from Romanesque work from Spain. And these are taken more from, Mistra. So that's sort of the Byzantine element. And the four living creatures were inspired by the Bury St. Edmund Gospel, painted in Britain, probably by Master Hugo in about, when is it done? 1200s? 12th century? 1125. Yeah. This is something I designed for the Portaitis icon in Iveron. So here I drew strongly on the Meteora Epitaphius
showed you earlier. So he got the six-winged seraph and then the four living creatures and the thrones here and the archangels here. So they can just be used as sort of an embroidery to decorate, but to emphasize that the thing is decorating is enthroned in heaven. Just a little note here about angels as stars. I showed you that depiction of angels as stars. It's quite an early way of suggesting angels. So this is an early icon of Christ in glory with the stars here on Mount Sinai. This is an early impostic icon. I'm assuming anyway that that's why they're there, they indicate the host of angels.
Isn't there some sort of biblical connection with Deuteronomy somewhere associating angels and stars?
Yeah. What's that one?
Look it up, maybe. Yeah. Okay. Mm. Just from writing that.
Yeah. So we come to the 5th, 6th, and 7th. And eighth ranks, dominions, virtues, powers, principalities mentioned by Dionysius. These aren't really represented in a special way if at all in iconography, really in iconography. Arche venomis, it says here. So dominions and powers. So where do you find these four ranks depicted? They're basically depicted like archangels. This is the baptistry in Florence. So here you have angels just depicted like ordinary archangels, but above them you have, it's difficult to read, but what I can make out from this photograph, it mentions the dominions, virtues, powers, and principalities. I think that's thrones there. Got the seraphim cherubim, obviously. More difficult to read on the screen actually than on the computer, but that's it's one of the few depictions, attempts to depict these nine ranks all together in one place. We're talking earlier about the bodiless nature of archangels and angels. One way of depicting that bodiness is literally to chop the bodies off. You just have them with the head and shoulder and the rest is not there. You find that, say, with the crucifixion of Christ, you have the angels sometimes at the top. This is in San Marco. We come now finally to our demons, how demons are depicted. Of course, demons are fallen angels, so they're always depicted with wings. This is Archangel Michael staring the demon. So let's look at a number of the things that angels that were lost by the demons when they fell from grace. Their rebellion meant that they lost their radiance. So they're always black. Black absorbs light, it doesn't emit light. So demons are shown as black. They've lost their radiance. They've pulled the plug out and the lamp's gone out. They're black. It's interesting that Satan, the devil himself, the chief demon, for like this, depicted as an old man here. I think sanctity keeps you young in a way. And it's amazing if Father Zaffroni, you know, how young he always looked, how clear his flesh looked. But sin actually ages you, as it were. It sort of wears you out as an unnatural state. When you live unnaturally, this conflict, and that always ages you. So he's depicted as an aged man. Demons are normally depicted as quite small because they've lost their power. They appear like a bully. A bully tries to appear a lot stronger than they are. You resist them and they shrink away quickly. So that's one of the tricks of the demons. They try to make us feel as if we're powerless, but in fact, they haven't got power. If we haven't got power, so we give it to them. So here, they're like flying, really. Just, you have it.
to great greatness, this depiction here. It's a famous icon there. Here, interestingly, they're shown a bit larger than normal in relation to the to humans. And most other depictions, they'd be in scale, probably about that big. Why do you think in this particular icon the begins to be made quite large in relation to the humans?
Because that's what
we think of. Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is all, of course, inspired by St. John of Valera's work, The Ladder of Divine Ascent. So it's really warning you, you know, you're on a spiritual journey, you climb the upper ladder, you can fall off. Beware of the devils and the tricks. They've only got strength in themselves, they've got cunning. Cunning is distorted wisdom. There's nothing worse than high intelligence being used to destructive ends. So here, I think the argument would have made them larger, just to sort of make you aware that, you know, they're big in their cunning, they're not big in their own power. I've lost that, but they're big in their cunning. Always notice as making an icon, I always try to sort of, even if I've done the icon subject many times before, it's good to sort of read the text, talk to the person commissioning, you know, study the liturgical text, the scriptures, to try to get underneath it and understand why things are done. So you're not just sort of painting of a scene. You're painting that scene, you're experiencing it for yourself, so you can do things with understanding, or do something new with understanding, not just copying. This is great, isn't it? This is from the Codex Gigas, which is probably the biggest book, illuminated book in the world. It's a massive thing. Sin always disfigures. I mean, sin has no virtue in it, no life in itself. Sin is like a virus. A virus hasn't got life in itself. It's got to attach itself to something and take living DNA from the cell it attaches to. The demons distort. It's all to do with distortion of God-given things. So this wonderful depiction here shows how, you know, it's a combination of human elements, creature elements, it's deformity. It's an unnatural state. So in what places are demons depicted? A common place is in the punishments of hell. So this is the back wall, the western wall of Torcello, an island just out of Venice. And you can see the Day of Judgment here, the resurrection, Christ surrounded by the 12 disciples, and the angels, and the Day of Judgment, the angels blowing the trumpets here, and the punishment of the unrighteous and the rewarding of the virtuous. So the demons are sort of torturing, basically, those who haven't repented. It's a curse. You have them in icons, most famously this particular one here where they're shown tempting. Here, Satan's depicted as a serpent being crushed under the cross. What does this relate to? Why do you have a serpent under the cross? What Old Testament verse does this refer to?
Genesis,
yeah. Be more specific?
The serpent should be crushed under the cross.
That's right, yes. Be crushed under your heel. So Christ crushes the serpent under his heel. So another place where demons are depicted is the temptation of Christ. Interestingly here, my guess anyway, is that devils here are depicted like Moorish invaders. At the time, Venice, of course, is a marine republic, and depended on boats going to and forth freely, so it became on its trading, so it made its money from trading. And the Moorish pirates began to wreak havoc. So the Moorish pirates were sort of acquainted with evil, so it seems to me that they're sort of drawn on the Moorish here to indicate demons tempting Christ. Icons of Michael, sometimes you have our demons depicted being speared to show the power of angels over demons.
There was a programme a few months ago where the art historian suggested that one of the oldest depictions of a devil was this blue angel here in the Apollinari Nuovo in Ravenna. Who knows? I think it's more the angel of death. This is the day of judgment, sorting the ghosts from the sheep. Don't know. I'd just like to conclude by saying that the whole role of any depictions of angels is to remind us that any worship on earth is participation in worship in heaven. And when we see our angels, you know, we ought to be reminded that we are in the same family, that they are different creations, they're not part of the human family, they are part of the heavenly family. And I just love it how, you see very vaguely here, so it goes actually back to fun. He should be on the other side. That's Gabriel and the Mother of God on the other side. So this is the Annunciation, but the conversation between the two is actually happening across real space. You're not looking at life over there, you're watching some historical event. But this conversation is like two people on either side talking to each other, and you're involved in this conversation, hearing this conversation. And of course, the liturgical text of Annunciation, our dialogue between Gabriel and Mary, it's a fantastic thing. She doesn't say, "Yes, I believe you." She tests him. She tests Gabriel. "Now, how do I know you're not a demon disguised as a good angel? I don't want to repeat Eve's mistake and just sort of gobble up your words and say, yes, I'll do whatever you suggest." And Gabriel praises Eve, praises Mary for testing him. You think, well, she's not believing him, she's doubting, but no, she's testing him. And then eventually she comes to realise this is a real angel speaking and speaking God's word. So if we can imagine ourselves in worship being involved in this conversation between heaven and earth and between angels and men. And if you've been to an after-night service or been to an all-night vigil, it's amazing because these chandeliers here are lit and swung at different points in the service. And these candlesticks made of beeswax normally are lit. So when these are moving, and of course there's no natural light, there's no unnatural light, no electrical light, and it's at night, so you don't get light from outside. This is the only light you've got. So they're like stars, they're like angels sort of dancing in heaven. And you've got the cantor with his long robe, Mandir, who goes between the two choirs, left and right. So he's like an angel, whooshing back and forwards with his Mandir flowing. And you've got the saints, Mother of God, and Christ in the dome. So you are really experiencing our worship in heaven. Good, thank you.
Thank you.